Chapter 4. At Kamar, Belgarath ran across an old friend in a tavern near the harbor. When he brought the bearded, fur-clad Kerik to the inn where they were staying, Polgara gave the swaying sailor a penetrating look. "How long have you been drunk, Captain Greldick?"
"What day is it?"
His reply was vague. She told him.
"Astonishing," he belched. "Pardon me," he apologized. "I appear to have lost track of several days somewhere. Do you know by any chance what week it is?"
"Greldick, do you absolutely have to get drunk every time you are in port?"
Greldick looked thoughtfully at the ceiling, scratching at his beard.
"Now that you mention it, Polgara, I believe I do. I hadn't really thought about it that way before, but now that you suggest it..."
She gave him a hard stare, but the look he returned was deliberately impudent.
"Don't waste your time, Polgara. I'm not married. I've never been married, and I'm not ever going to get married. I'm not ruining any woman's life by the way I behave, and it is absolutely certain that no woman is ever going to ruin mine. Now, Belgarath says that you want to go to Riva. I'll round up my crew, and we'll leave on the morning tide."
"Will your crew be sober enough to find their way out of the harbor?"
He shrugged. "We might bump into a Tolnedran merchantman or two on the way out, but we'll find our way to the open sea eventually. Drunk or sober, my crew is the best afloat. We'll put you on the quay at Riva by mid-afternoon on the day after tomorrow. Unless the sea freezes solid between now and then, in which case it might take a couple of hours longer."
He belched again. "Pardon me," he said, swaying back and forth and peering at her with his bleary eyes.
"Greldick," Belgarath said admiringly, "you are the bravest man alive."
"Oh, the sea doesn't frighten me. I wasn't talking about the sea."
About noon of the following day, Greldick's ship was running before a freshening breeze through foaming whitecaps. A few of the less indisposed members of his crew lurched about the deck tending the lines and keeping a more or less alert eye on the stern, where Greldick, puffy-eyed and obviously suffering, clung to the tiller.
"Aren't you going to shorten your sail?" Belgarath asked him.
"What for?"
"Because if you leave full sail up in this kind of wind, you will uproot your mast." "You stick to your sorcery, Belgarath," Greldick told him, "and leave the sailing to me. We're making good time, and the deck planking starts to buckle up long before the mast is in any danger."
"How long before?"
"Almost a minute or so, most of the time."
Belgarath stared at him.
"I think I'll go below," he said at last. "That's a good idea."
By evening the wind had abated, and Greldick's ship continued across a quieter sea as night fell. There were only occasional glimpses of the stars, but they were sufficient. When the sun rose the next morning, it was, as the wayward captain had predicted, dead astern. By mid-morning the dark, craggy rocks and jagged peaks that formed the crest of the Isle of the Winds were poked above the western horizon, and their ship was once again plunging like a spirited horse through the white caps under a crisp blue sky. A broad grin split Greldick's bearded face as his ship swooped and lurched and shuddered her way through the hammering seas, throwing out great sheets of sparkling spray each time she knifed into a wave.
"That's a very unreliable man," Polgara said, giving the captain a disapproving stare.
"He really seems to be a good sailor, Paul," Dernick said mildly.
"That's not what I was talking about, Dernick."
"Oh."
The ship tacked smoothly between two rocky headlands and into the sheltered harbor of the city of Riva. The gray stone buildings mounted steeply upward toward the grim, menacing battlements of the citadel, which brooded over the city and the harbor below.
"This place always looks so bleak," Durnick noted.
"Bleak and uninviting."
"That was sort of the idea when they built it, Durnick," Belgarath replied. "They didn't really want many visitors."
Then at the end of a starboard tack, Greldick swung his tiller hard over, and his ship, her prow knifing through the dark water, ran directly at the stone quay jutting out from the foot of the city. At the last possible moment, he swung his tiller again. To the flapping of her patched sails, the ship coasted the last few yards and bumped gently against the salt-crusted stones of the quay.
"Did you think anybody saw us coming in Tul'Gerion?" Durnick asked.
"Evidently so," Belgarath replied, pointing toward the arched gate that had just swung open to reveal the broad flight of stone stairs mounting upward within the thick, high walls protecting the seaward side of Reva.
A number of official-looking men were coming through the gate. In the center of the group strode a tall young man with sandy-colored hair and a serious expression on his face.
"Let's step over to the other side of the ship," Belgarath suggested to Durnick and Erend. "I want to surprise him."
"Welcome to Riva, Captain Greldick,"
Erend recognized Geryon's voice, even though it sounded older, more sure now. Greldick squinted appraisingly over the rail.
"You have grown, boy," he said to the King of Riva.
A man as free as Greldick almost never felt the need for using customary terms of respect.
"It's been going around lately,"
Geryon replied dryly.
"Almost everybody my age has come down with it."
"I've brought you some visitors."
Grinning, Belgarath moved across the deck to the quayside railing with Durnick and Erend close behind him.
"Grandfather?" Geryon's face was completely astonished. "What are you doing here? And Durnick and Erend?"
"Actually, it was your aunt's idea," Belgarath told him.
"Is Aunt Paul here, too?" "Of course I am,"
Belgarath replied calmly, emerging from the low-roofed cabin under the stern.
"Aunt Paul!" Geryon exclaimed, looking dumbfounded. "Don't stare, Geryon," she told him, adjusting the collar of her blue cloak. "It's impolite."
"But why didn't you let me know you were coming? What are you all doing here?"
"Visiting, dear. People do that from time to time."
When they joined the young king on the quay, there were the usual embraces and handshakes and the long looks into each other's faces that go with reunions. Erend, however, was much more interested in something else. As they started the climb up through the gray city toward the citadel brooding above it, he tugged once at Geryon's sleeve.
"Horse?" he asked.
Geryon looked at him.
"He's in the stables, Erend. He'll be happy to see you."
Erend smiled and nodded.
"Does he still talk that way?" Geryon asked Durnick. "Just one word at a time like that?" "I thought, well..."
"Most of the time he speaks normally for his age," Durnick replied. "But he's been thinking about the colt ever since we left the Vale, and sometimes, when he gets excited, he slips back to the old way."
"He listens, though," Bolgara added, "which is more than I can say about another boy when he was that age."
Geryon laughed.
"Was I really that difficult, Aunt Paul?" "Not difficult, dear. You just didn't listen."
When they arrived at the citadel, the Raven Queen greeted them under the high, thick-walled arch of the front gate. Tenedra was as exquisite as Erend remembered her. Her coppery-colored hair was caught at the back of her head by a pair of golden combs, and the ringlets tumbled down her back in a flaming cascade. Her green eyes were large. She was tiny, not much taller than Erend, but she was every inch a queen. She greeted them all regally, embracing Belgarath and Durnick, and lightly kissing Polgara's cheek. Then she held out both hands to Erend, and he took them in his and looked into her eyes. There was a barrier there, the faintest hint of the defensive tightening with which she kept the hurt away. She drew him to her and kissed him. Even in that gesture, he could feel the unhappy tenseness that she was probably no longer even aware of. As she removed her soft lips from his cheek, Arend once again looked deeply into her eyes, letting all of the love and hope and compassion he felt for her flow into his gaze. Then, without even thinking, he reached out his hand and gently touched her cheek. Her eyes went very wide, and her lip began to tremble. That faint touch of agate-hard defensiveness about her began to crumble. Two great tears welled up in her eyes. Then, with a broken-hearted wail, she turned and stumbled blindly, her arms outstretched.
"Oh, Lady Polgara," she cried.
Polgara calmly took the sobbing little queen in her arms and held her. She looked directly into Eren's face, however, and one of her eyebrows was raised questioningly. Eren returned her look and gave her a calm, answering nod.
"Well," Belgareth said,
slightly embarrassed by Tenedra's sudden weeping. He scratched at his beard and looked around the inner courtyard of the citadel and the broad granite steps leading up to the massive door.
"Have you got anything to drink, Candy?" he asked Geryon.
Polgara, her arms still about the weeping Tenedra, gave him a level look.
"Isn't it a bit early, father?"
"Oh, I don't think so," he replied blandly. "A bit of ale helps to settle the stomach after a long sea voyage."
"There is always some excuse, isn't there?"
"Yes, I can usually manage to think of something."
Erend spent the afternoon in the exercise yard at the rear of the royal stables. The chestnut-colored colt was not really a colt anymore, but rather a full-grown young stallion. His dark coat was glossy, and his muscles rippled under that coat as he ran in a wide circle about the yard. The single white patch on his shoulder seemed almost incandescent in the bright sunlight. The horse had known somehow that Erend was coming, and had been restive and high-strung all morning. The stableman cautioned Erend about that.
"Be careful of him. He's a bit flighty today for some reason."
"He'll be fine now,"
Erend said, calmly unlatching the door to the young horse's stall.
"I wouldn't go—"
the stableman started sharply, half reaching out as if to pull the boy back. But Erend had already entered the stall with the wide-eyed animal. The horse snorted once and pranced nervously, his hooves thudding on the straw-covered floor. He stopped and stood quivering until Erend put out his hand and touched that bowed neck. Then everything was all right between them. Erend pushed the door of the stall open wider, and, with the horse contentedly nuzzling at his shoulder, led the way out of the stable past the astonished groom. For the time being, it was enough for the two of them just to be together, to share the bond which was between them and had somehow existed even before they had met, and in a peculiar way, even before either of them was born. There would be more later, but for now, this was enough. When the purple hue of evening began to creep up the eastern sky, Erend fed the horse, promised that he would come again the following day, and went back into the citadel in search of his friends. He found them seated in a low-ceilinged dining hall. This room was smaller than the great main banquet hall, and it was less formal. It was, perhaps, as close to being homey as any room in this bleak fortress could be.
"Did you have a pleasant afternoon?"
Aaron nodded to Polgara.
"And was the horse glad to see you?"
"Yes."
"And now you are hungry, I suppose?"
"Well, a little."
He looked around the room, noting that the Raven Queen was not present.
"Where's Tenedra?"
"She's a little tired,"
Polgara replied.
"She and I had a long talk this afternoon."
Aaron looked at her and understood. Then he looked around again.
"I really am sort of hungry."
She laughed a warm, fond laugh. "All boys are the same."
"Would you really want us to be different?"
Geryon asked her.
"No, I don't suppose I would."
The next morning, quite early, Polgara and Erend were in front of the fire in the apartment that had always been hers. Polgara sat in a high-backed chair with a fragrant cup of tea on the small table beside her. She wore a deep blue velvet dressing gown and held a large ivory comb. Erend sat on a carpet-covered footstool directly in front of her, enduring a part of the morning ritual. The washing of the face, ears, and neck did not take all that much time, but for some reason the combing of his hair always seemed to fill up the better part of a quarter of an hour. Aaron's personal tastes in the arrangement of his hair were fairly elemental. As long as it was out of his eyes, it was satisfactory. Polgara, however, seemed to find a great deal of entertainment in pulling a comb through his soft, pale blonde curls. Now and then, at odd times of the day, he would see that peculiar softness come into her eyes and see her fingers twitching almost of their own will toward a comb. And he would know that, if he did not immediately become very busy with something, he would be wordlessly seated in a chair to have his hair attended to. There was a respectful tap on the door. "Yes, Geryon," she replied. "I hope I'm not too early, Aunt Paul. May I come in?" "Of course, dear." Geryon wore a blue doublet and hose and soft leather shoes. Erend had noticed that if he had any choice in the matter, the young king of Reva almost always wore blue. "Good morning, dear," Polgara said, her fingers still busy with the comb. "Good morning, Aunt Paul." Geryon looked at the boy, who sat fidgeting slightly on the stool in front of Polgara's chair. "Good morning, Erend."
"Belgarion,"
Erend said, nodding.
"Hold your head still, Erend,"
Polgara said calmly. "Would you like some tea?" she asked Geryon. "Oh, no, thank you." He drew up another chair and sat down across from her. "Where's Durnik?"
"He's taking a walk around the parapet,"
Polgara told him.
"Durnik likes to be outside when the sun comes up."
"Yes," Geryon smiled. "I seem to remember that from Faldor's farm."
"Is everything all right? With the rooms, I mean. I am always very comfortable here, in some ways. It is the closest thing I've ever had to a permanent home. At least, until now."
She looked around with satisfaction at the deep crimson velvet drapes and the dark leather upholstery of her chairs, then sighed contentedly.
"These have been your rooms for a long time, haven't they?"
"Yes. Beldaran set them aside for me after she and Iron Grip were married."
"What was he like?"
"Iron Grip?
Very tall, almost as tall as his father, and immensely strong."
She turned her attention back to Eren's hair.
"Was he as tall as Berak?"
"Taller, but not quite so thick-bodied. King Kerak himself was 7 feet tall, and all of his sons were very big men. Dras Bolnek was like a tree trunk. He blotted out the sky. Iron Grip was leaner, and he had a fierce black beard and piercing blue eyes. By the time he and Beldoran were married, there were touches of gray in his hair and beard. But even so, there was a kind of innocence about him that we could all sense. It was very much like the innocence we all feel in Erend here."
"You seem to remember him very well. For me, he has always been just somebody in a legend. Everybody knows about things that he did, but we don't know anything about him as a real man."
"I would remember him a bit more acutely, Geryon. After all, there had been the possibility that I might have married him."
"Iron Grip?"
"Aldur told Father to send one of his daughters to the Riven King to be his wife. Father had to choose between Beldaran and me. I think the old wolf made the right choice. But I still looked at Iron Grip in a rather special way."
She sighed and then smiled a bit ruefully.
"I don't think I'd have made him a very good wife. My sister Beldaran was sweet and gentle and very beautiful. I was neither gentle nor very attractive."
"But you're the most beautiful woman in the world, Aunt Paul."
"It's nice of you to say that, Geryon, but when I was 16 I wasn't what most people would call pretty. I was tall and gangly. My knees were always skinned and my face was usually dirty. Your grandfather was never very conscientious about looking after the appearances of his daughters. Sometimes whole weeks would go by without a comb ever touching my hair. I didn't like my hair very much, anyway. Beldoran's was soft and golden, but mine was like a horse's mane, and there was this ugly white streak." She absently touched the white lock at her left brow with the comb.
"What caused that?"
"Your grandfather touched me there with his hand the first time he saw me, when I was just a baby. The lock turned white instantly. We are all marked in one way or another, you know. You have the mark on your palm. I have this white lock. Your grandfather has a mark just over his heart. It's in different places on each one of us, but it means the same thing.
What does it mean?
It has to do with what we are, dear. She turned Erend around and looked at him, her lips pursed. Then she gently touched the curls just over his ears. Anyway, as I was saying, I was wild and willful and not at all pretty when I was young. The Vale of Aldor is not really a very good place for a girl to grow up, and a group of crotchety old sorcerers is not really a very good substitute for a mother. They tend to forget that you are around. You remember that huge, ancient tree in the middle of the vale? He nodded. I climbed up into that tree once and stayed there for 2 weeks before anyone noticed that I had not been underfoot lately. That sort of thing can make a girl feel neglected and unloved.
How did you finally find out that you're really beautiful, I mean?
She smiled. Oh, that's another story, dear. She looked at him rather directly. Do you suppose we can stop tiptoeing around the subject now?
What?
That business in your letter about you and Zenedra.
Oh, that. I probably shouldn't have bothered you with it, Aunt Paul. It is my problem, after all.
He looked away uncomfortably.
Geryon, in our particular family, there is no such thing as a private problem. I thought you knew that by now. Exactly what is the difficulty with Zenedra?
It's just not working, Aunt Paul, he said disconsolately. There are things that I absolutely have to see to by myself, and she wants me to spend every waking minute with her. Well, at least she used to. Now we go for days without seeing each other at all. We don't sleep in the same bed anymore, and...
He looked suddenly at Erend and coughed uncomfortably.
There, Polgara said to Erend, as if nothing had happened. I guess you're presentable now. Why don't you put on that brown wool cape and go find Dernick? Then the two of you can go down to the stables and visit the horse.
All right, Polgara,
Erend agreed, slipping down off of the stool and going to fetch the cape.
He's a very good little boy, isn't he?
Geryon said to Polgara.
Most of the time. If we can keep him out of the river behind my mother's house. For some reason he seems to feel incomplete if he can't fall into the water once or twice a month.
Erend kissed Polgara and started toward the door.
Tell Dernick that I said the two of you can enjoy yourselves this morning.
She gave Geryon a direct look.
I think I'm going to be busy here for a few hours.
All right, Erend said, and went out into the corridor. He gave only the briefest of thoughts to the problem which had made Geryon and Zenedra so unhappy. Polgara had already taken the matter into hand, and Erend knew that she would fix things. The problem itself was not a large one, but it had somehow been exploded into something of monstrous proportions by the arguments it had caused. The smallest misunderstanding, Erend realized, could sometimes fester like a hidden wound, if words spoken in haste and in heat were allowed to stand without apology or forgiveness. He also realized that Geryon and Zenedra loved each other, so much so that they were both extremely vulnerable to those hasty and heated words. Each had an enormous power to hurt the other. Once they were both made fully aware of that, the whole business could be allowed to blow over. The corridors of the Citadel of Riva were lighted by torches held in iron rings protruding from the stone walls. Erend walked down a broad hallway leading to the east side of the fortress and the steps leading to the parapet and the battlements above. When he reached the thick east wall, he paused to look out one of the narrow windows that had admitted a slender band of steel-gray light from the dawn sky. The citadel was high above the city, and the gray stone buildings and narrow cobblestone streets below were still lost in shadow and morning mist. Here and there, lighted windows gleamed in the houses of early risers. The clean salt smell of the sea, carried by an onshore breeze, wafted over the island kingdom. Contained within the ancient stones of the citadel itself was the sense of desolation the people of Rita Irongrip had felt when they had first glimpsed this rocky isle rising grim and storm-lashed out of a laden sea. And within those stones was that stern sense of duty that had made the Rivens wrest their fortress and their city directly from the rock itself, to stand forever in defense of the Orb of Aldur. Arend climbed the flight of stone stairs and found Durnik standing at the battlements, looking out over the sea of the winds that was rolling endlessly to crash in long, muted combers against the rocky shore.
"She finished with your hair, I see," Durnik noted.
Arend nodded.
"Finally?"
Durnik laughed.
"We can both put up with a few things if they please her, can't we?"
"Yes. She's talking with Belgarion right now. I think she wants us to stay away until they've talked it all out."
Durnik nodded.
That's the best way, really. Paul and Geryon are very close. He'll tell her things when they're all alone that he wouldn't say if we were around. I hope she can get things straightened out between him and Zenedra."
"Polgora will fix it," Arend assured him.
From somewhere in a meadow high above them, where the morning sun had already touched the emerald grass, a shepherdess lifted her voice to sing to the flock. She sang of love in a pure, unschooled voice that rose like a bird song.
"Ah, that's the way love should be," Durnik said.
"Simple and uncomplicated and clear, just like that girl's voice."
"I know," Arend said. "Polgora said we could go visit the horse whenever you're finished up here."
"Yeah, of course," Durnik said. "And we could probably stop by the kitchen and pick up some breakfast along the way."
"That's an awfully good idea, too,"
Arend said. The day went very well. The sun was warm and bright, and the horse frolicked in the exercise yard almost like a puppy.
"The king won't let us break him," one of the grooms told Durnik. "He hasn't even been trained to a halter yet. His Majesty said something about this being a very special horse, which I don't understand at all. A horse is a horse, isn't it?"
"It has to do with something that happened when he was born."
"They're all born the same."
"You had to have been there."
At supper that evening, Geryon and Zenedra were looking rather tentatively across the table at each other, and Polgora had a mysterious little smile playing across her lips. When they had all finished eating, Geryon stretched and yawned somewhat theatrically.
"Well, for some reason, I'm feeling very tired tonight."
"The rest of you can sit up and talk if you'd like, but I think I'll go to bed."
"That might not be a bad idea, Geryon,"
Polgora told him. He got to his feet, and Arend could feel his trembling nervousness. With an almost agonizing casualness, he turned to Zenedra.
"Coming, dear?"
he asked, putting an entire peace proposal into those two words. Zenedra looked at him, and her heart was in her eyes.
"Why, yes, Geryon," she said with a rosy little blush. "I believe I will. I seem to be very tired, too."
"Good night, children," Polgora said to them in tones of warm affection.
"Sleep well."
"What did you say to them?"
Belgareth asked his daughter when the royal couple had left the room hand in hand.
"Oh, a great many things, father," she replied smugly.
One of them must have done the trick. Durnik, be a good fellow and top this off for me."
He passed his empty tankard to Durnik, who sat beside the ale barrel. Polgora was so pleased with her success that she did not even comment on it. It was well after midnight when Arend awoke with a slight start.
"You are a very sound sleeper,"
a voice that seemed to be inside his mind said to him.
"I was dreaming,"
Arend replied.
"I noticed that," the voice said dryly. "Pull on some clothes. I need you in the throne room."
Arend obediently got out of bed and pulled on his tunic and his short, soft Sindarian boots.
"Be quiet," the voice told him. "Let's not wake up Polgora and Durnik."
Quietly, they left the apartment and went down the long, deserted corridors to the Hall of the Riven King, the vast throne room, where, 3 years before,
Erend had placed the Orb of Aldur into Geryon's hand, and had forever changed the young man's life. The huge door creaked slightly as Erend pulled it open, and he heard a voice inside calling out, "Who's there?"
"It's only me, Belgarion."
The great hall was illuminated by the soft blue radiance of the Orb of Aldur, standing on the pommel of the huge Sword of Riva, hanging point downward above the throne.
"What are you doing, wandering around so late, Erend?"
The Riven King was sprawled on his throne with his leg cocked up over one of the arms.
"I was told to come here."
Geryon looked at him strangely.
"Told? Who told you?" "You know,"
Erend said, stepping inside the hall and closing the door.
"Him."
Geryon blinked.
"Does he talk to you, too?" "This is the first time. I've known about him, though."
"If he's never..." Geryon broke off and looked sharply up at the orb, his eyes startled. The soft blue light of the stone had suddenly changed to a deep, angry red. Erend could very clearly hear a strange sound. For all of the time he had carried the orb, his ears had been filled with the crystalline shimmer of its song. But now, that shimmer seemed to have taken on an ugly iron overtone, as if the stone had encountered something or someone that filled it with a raging anger.
"Beware."
That voice, which they had both heard quite clearly, said to them in tones which could not be ignored.
"Beware, Zandramas."
Chapter 5. As soon as it was daylight, the two of them went in search of Belgarath. Erend could sense that Geryon was troubled, and he himself felt that the warning they had received concerned a matter of such importance that everything else must be set aside in the face of it. They had not really spoken much about it during those dark, silent hours while they sat together in the hall of the Riven King, waiting for the first light to touch the eastern horizon. Instead, they had both watched the Orb of Aldur closely. But the stone, after that one strange moment of crimson anger, had returned to its customary azure glow. They found Belgarath seated before a recently rekindled fire in a low-beamed hall close to the royal kitchen. On the table not far from where he sat lay a large chunk of bread and a generous slab of cheese. Erend looked at the bread and cheese, realizing suddenly that he was hungry, and wondering if Belgarath might be willing to share some of his breakfast. The old sorcerer seemed lost in thought as he gazed into the dancing flames, and his stout gray cloak was drawn about his shoulders, though the hall was not cold.
"You two are up early,"
he noted, as Geryon and Erend entered and came to join him by the fireside.
"So are you, Grandfather?"
"I had a peculiar dream," the old man replied. "I have been trying to shake it off for several hours now. For some reason, I dreamed that the orb had turned red."
"It did,"
Erend told him quietly. Belgarath looked at him sharply.
"Yes, we both saw it, Grandfather. We were in the throne room a few hours ago, and the orb suddenly turned red. Then that voice that I've got in here," he tapped his forehead, "said to beware of Zandramas."
"Zandramas?" Belgarath said with a puzzled look. "Is that a name or a thing or what?"
"I don't really know, Grandfather. But both Erend and I heard it, didn't we, Erend?"
Erend nodded, his eyes still on the bread and cheese.
"What were the two of you doing in the throne room at that hour?"
"I was asleep," Geryon answered. Then his face flushed slightly. "Well, sort of asleep. Tenedra and I talked until quite late. We haven't talked very much lately, and so we had a lot of things to say to each other. Anyway, he told me to get up and go to the throne room."
Belgarath looked at Erend.
"And you?"
"He woke me up," Erend replied. "And he..."
"Hold it," Belgarath said sharply. "Who woke you up?"
The same one who woke up Garion.
You know who he is?
Yes.
And you know what he is?
Erend nodded.
Has he ever spoken to you before?
No.
But you knew immediately who and what he is?
Yes. He told me that he needed me in the throne room, so I got dressed and went. When I got there, the orb turned red, and the voice said to beware of Zandramas.
Belgarath was frowning.
You are both absolutely positive that the orb changed color?
Yes, grandfather, Garion assured him. And it sounded different, too. It usually makes this kind of ringing noise, like the sound a bell makes after you strike it. This was altogether different.
And you are sure that it turned red? I mean, it wasn't just a darker shade of blue or something.
No, grandfather. It was definitely red.
Belgarath got up out of his chair, his face suddenly grim.
Come with me,
he said shortly, and started toward the door.
Where are we going?
To the library. I need to check on something.
On what?
Let's wait until I read it. This is important. I want to be sure that I've got it right.
As he passed the table, Erend picked up the piece of cheese and broke off part of it. He took a large bite as he followed Belgarath and Garion from the room. They went quickly through the dim, torch-lit corridors and up a steep, echoing flight of narrow stone steps. In the past few years, Belgarath's expression had become rather whimsical and touched with a sort of lazy self-indulgence. All trace of that was now gone. His eyes were intent, very alert. When they reached the library, the old man took a pair of candles from a dusty table and lighted them from the torch hanging in an iron ring just outside the door. Then he came back inside and set one of the candles down.
"Close the door, Garion," he said, still holding the other candle. "We don't want to be disturbed."
Wordlessly, Garion shut the solid oak door. Belgarath went over to the wall, lifted his candle, and began to run his eyes over the row upon row of dusty, leather-bound books and the neatly stacked, silk-wrapped scrolls.
"There," he said, pointing to the top shelf. "Reach that scroll down for me, Garion, the one wrapped in blue silk."
Garion stretched up on his tiptoes and took down the scroll. He looked at it curiously before handing it to his grandfather.
"Are you sure?" he asked. "This isn't the Mrin Codex, you know."
"No," Belgarath told him. "It isn't. Don't get your attention so locked onto the Mrin Codex that you ignore all of the others."
He set down his candle and carefully untied the silver-tasseled cord binding the scroll. He stripped off the blue silk cover and began to unroll the crackling parchment, his eyes running quickly over the ancient script.
"Ah, here it is. Behold," he read, "in the day that Aldur's orb burns hot with crimson fire, shall the name of the Child of Dark be revealed."
"But Torak was the Child of Dark," Garion protested. "What is that scroll?"
"The Darin Codex," Belgarath told him. "It's not always as reliable as the Mrin, but it's the only one that mentions this particular event."
"What does it mean?"
Garion asked, looking perplexed.
"It is a bit complicated," Belgarath replied, his lips pursed and his eyes still fixed on the passage in question. "Rather simply put, there are two prophecies."
"Yes, I knew that, but I thought that when Torak died, the other one just, well..."
"Not exactly. I don't think it's that simple. The two have been meeting in these confrontations since before the beginning of the world. Each time there's a Child of Light and a Child of Dark. When you and Torak met at K'tal Mishrak, you were the Child of Light. Torak was the Child of Dark. It wasn't the first time the two had met. Apparently, it was not to be the last, either."
"You mean that it's not over yet?"
Garion demanded incredulously.
"Well, not according to this,"
Belgarath said, tapping the parchment.
"All right, if this Zandramas is the Child of Dark, who is the child of light. As far as I know, Geryon, you are.
Me? Still?
Until we hear something to the contrary.
Why me?
Haven't we had this conversation before? Belgoroth asked dryly. Geryon's shoulders slumped.
Now I've got this story about again, on top of everything else.
Oh, stop feeling sorry for yourself, Geryon. We're all doing what we have to do, and sniveling about it won't change a thing.
I wasn't sniveling.
Or whatever you call it, stop it. Get to work.
What am I supposed to do?
Geryon's tone was just a trifle sullen.
You can start here, the old man said, waving one hand to indicate all of the dusty books and silk-wrapped scrolls. This is perhaps one of the world's best collections of prophecy. Western prophecy, at least. It doesn't include the oracles of the Malorian Grolems, of course, or the collection that Tuchik had at Rakhtol, or the secret books of those people at Kel. But it is a place to start. I want you to read your way through this, all of it, and see if you can find out anything at all about this Zandramas. Make a note of every reference to the Child of Dark. Most of them will probably have to do with Torak, but there might be some that mean Zandramas instead.
He frowned slightly.
While you are at it, keep an eye out for anything that has to do with something called the Sardian or Thrag Sardius.
What's that?
I don't know. Belden ran across the term in Meloria. It might be important, or it might not.
Geryon looked around the library, his face blanching slightly.
Are you telling me that this is all prophecy?
Oh, of course not. A lot of it, most of it probably, is the collected ravings of assorted madmen, all faithfully written down.
Why would anybody want to write down what crazy people say?
Because the Mrin Codex is precisely that, the ravings of a lunatic. The Mrin prophet was so crazy that he had to be chained up. A lot of very conscientious people went out after he died and wrote down the gibberish of every madman they could find, on the off chance that there might be prophecy hidden in it somewhere.
How do I tell the difference?
I'm not really sure. Maybe, after you've read them all, you'll be able to come up with a way to separate them. If you do, let us know. It could save us all a lot of time.
Geryon looked around the library in dismay.
But, Grandfather, this could take years.
Well, you had probably better get started then, hadn't you? Try to concentrate on things that are supposed to happen after the death of Torak. We're all fairly familiar with the things that led up to that.
Grandfather, I'm not really a scholar. What if I miss something?
Don't, Belgarath told him firmly. Like it or not, Geryon, you are one of us. You have the same responsibilities that the rest of us do. You might as well get used to the idea that the whole world depends upon you. And you also might just as well forget that you ever heard the words, "Why me?" That is the objection of a child. You're a man now.
Then the old man turned and looked very hard at Erend.
And what are you doing mixed up in all of this? He asked.
I'm not sure, Erend replied calmly. We'll probably have to wait and see, won't we?
That afternoon, Erend was alone with Polgora in the warm comfort of her sitting room. She sat by the fire with her favorite blue robe about her, and her feet on a carpeted footstool. She held an embroidery hoop in her hands and was humming softly as her needle flashed in the golden firelight. Erend sat in the leather-covered armchair opposite of hers, nibbling on an apple and watching her as she sewed. One of the things he loved about her was her ability to radiate a kind of calm contentment when she was engaged in simple domestic tasks. At such quiet times, her very presence was soothing. The pretty Riven girl who served as Polgora's maid tapped softly and entered the room.
Lady Polgora,
she said with a little curtsy.
My Lord Brand asks if he might have a word with you?
Of course, dear,
Polgora replied, laying aside her embroidery.
Show him in, please.
Erend had noticed that Polgara tended to call all young people dear, most of the time without even being aware that she was doing it. The maid escorted the tall, gray-haired Riven warder into the room, curtsied again, and then quietly withdrew.
"Polgara,"
Brand greeted her in his deep voice. He was a large, bulky man with a deeply lined face and tired, sad eyes. And he was the last Riven warder. During this centuries-long interregnum following the death of King Gorak at the hands of Queen Salmisera's assassins, the Isle of the Winds and the Riven people had been ruled by a line of men chosen for their ability and their absolute devotion to duty. So selfless had been that devotion that each Riven warder had submerged his own personality and had taken the name Brand. Now that Geryon had come at last to claim his throne, there was no further need for that centuries-old stewardship. So long as he lived, however, this big, sad-eyed man would be absolutely committed to the royal line, not perhaps so much to Geryon himself, but rather to the concept of the line, and to its perpetuation. It was with that thought uppermost in his mind that he came that quiet afternoon to thank Polgara for taking the estrangement of Geryon and his queen in hand.
How did they manage to grow so far apart? When they married, they were so close that you couldn't pry them away from each other.
It all started about a year ago, Brand replied in his rumbling voice. There are two powerful families on the northern end of the island. They had always been friendly, but a dispute arose over a property arrangement that was involved in a wedding between a young man from one family and a girl from the other. People from one family came to the citadel and presented their cause to Tenedra, and she issued a royal decree supporting them.
But she neglected to consult Geryon about it.
Brand nodded. When he found out, he was furious. There's no question that Tenedra had overstepped her authority. But Geryon revoked her decree in public.
Oh, dear, Polgara said. So that's what all of the bitterness was about. I couldn't really get a straight answer out of either of them.
They were probably a little too ashamed to admit it. Each one had humiliated the other in public. Neither one was mature enough just to forgive and let it slide. They kept wrangling at each other until the whole affair got completely out of hand. There were times when I wanted to shake them both, or maybe spank them.
Oh, that's an interesting idea, Polgara laughed. Why didn't you write and tell me they were having problems?
Belgarion told me not to, he replied helplessly.
Sometimes we have to disobey that kind of order.
I'm sorry, Polgara, but I cannot do that.
No, I suppose you couldn't. She turned to look at Erend, who was closely examining an exquisite piece of blown glass, a crystal wren perched on a budding twig. "Please don't touch it, Erend. It's fragile and very precious."
"Yes," he agreed. "I know."
And to reassure her, he clasped his hands firmly behind his back.
"Well," she turned back to Brand, "I hope the foolishness is all past now. I think we have restored peace to the royal house of Riva.
I certainly hope so, Brand said with a tired smile. I would definitely like to see an occupant on the royal nursery.
That might take a bit longer.
It is getting sort of important, Polgara, he said seriously. We are all a bit nervous about the lack of an heir to the throne. It's not only me. Anheg and Rodar and Kohag have all written to me about it. All of Aloria is holding its breath, waiting for Tenedra to start having children.
She is only 19, Brand.
Most Aelorn girls have had at least two babies by the time they are 19.
Tenedra is not Aelorn. She's not even entirely Tolnedrin. Her heritage is Dryad, and there are some peculiarities about Dryads and the way they mature.
That's going to be a little hard to explain to other Aelorns, Brand replied. There has to be an heir to the Riven throne. The line must continue.
Give them a little time, Brand, Polgara said placidly. They'll get around to it. The important thing was to get them back into the same bedroom. Perhaps a day or so later, when the sun was sparkling on the waters of the Sea of the Winds,
and a stiff onshore breeze was flecking the tops of the green waves with frothy whitecaps. A white Kerek warboat maneuvered its way ponderously between the two rocky headlands embracing the harbor at Rhytha. The ship's captain was also more than life-sized. With his red beard streaming in the wind, Barak, Earl of Trelheim, stood at his tiller, a look of studied concentration on his face as he worked his way through a tricky eddy just inside one of the protective headlands, and then across the harbor to the stone quay. Almost before his sailors had made the ship fast, Barak was coming up the long flight of granite steps to the citadel. Belgorath and Erend had been on the parapet atop the walls of the fortress, and had witnessed the arrival of Barak's ship. And so, when the big man reached the heavy gates, they were waiting for him.
"What are you doing here, Belgorath?" the burly Kerek asked. "I thought you were at the Vale."
Belgorath shrugged.
"We came by for a visit."
Barak looked at Erend.
"Hello, boy. Are Polgara and Dernek here too?"
"Yes," Erend replied. "They are all in the throne room watching Belgarion."
"What's he doing?"
"Being king," Belgorath said shortly.
"We saw you come into the harbor. Really impressive, wasn't it?"
Barak said proudly.
"Your ship steers like a pregnant whale, Barak," Belgorath told him bluntly. "You don't seem to have grasped the idea that bigger is not necessarily better."
Barak's face took on an injured expression.
"I don't make jokes about your possessions, Belgorath."
"I don't have any possessions, Barak. What brought you to Rhytha?"
"Anheg sent me. Is Geryon going to be much longer at whatever he's doing? We can go find out, I suppose."
The Riven King, however, had concluded the formal audience for that morning, and in the company of Tenedra, Polgara, and Dernek, had gone through a dim private passageway which led from the great hall of the Riven King to the royal apartments.
"Barak!"
Geryon exclaimed, hurrying forward to greet his old friend in the corridor outside the door to the apartment. Barak gave him a peculiar look and bowed respectfully.
"What is this all about?"
Geryon asked him with a puzzled look.
"You are still wearing your crown, Geryon,"
Polgara reminded him.
"And your state robes. All of that makes you look rather official."
"Oh," Geryon said, looking a bit abashed. "I forgot. Let's go inside."
He pulled open the door and led them all into the room beyond. With a broad grin, Barak enfolded Polgara in a vast bear hug.
"Barak," she said a trifle breathlessly, "you'd be much nicer at close quarters if you would remember to wash your beard after you have been eating smoked fish."
"I only had one," he told her.
"Oh, that's usually enough."
He turned then and put his bulky arms around Tenedra's tiny shoulders and kissed her soundly. The little queen laughed and caught her crown in time to keep it from sliding off of her head.
"You are right, Lady Polgara," she said. "He definitely has a certain fragrance about him."
"Geryon," Barak said plaintively, "I'm absolutely dying for a drink."
"Did all the ale barrels on your ship run dry?"
Polgara asked him.
"There's no drinking aboard the Seabird," Barak replied.
"Oh?"
"I want my sailors sober."
"Astonishing," she murmured.
"It's a matter of principle," Barak said piously. "They do need their wits about them," Belgorath agreed. "That big ship of his is not exactly what you would call responsive."
Barak gave him a hurt look. Geryon sent for ale, removed his crown and state robes with obvious relief, and invited them all to sit down. Once Barak had quenched his most immediate thirst, his expression became serious. He looked at Geryon.
"Anheg sent me to warn you that we are starting to get reports about the bear cult again."
"I thought they were all killed at Tol Mardu," Dernek said.
"Grodig's underlings were," Barak told him. "Unfortunately, Grodig was not the whole cult."
"I don't exactly follow you," Dernek said.
"It gets a little complicated.
You see, the bear cult has always been here, really. It is a fundamental part of the religious life of the more remote parts of Carrick, Dresnia, and Algaria. Every so often, though, somebody with more ambition than good sense, like Grodeg, gains control and tries to establish the cult in the cities. The cities are where the power is, and somebody like Grodeg automatically tries to use the cult to take them over. The problem is that the bear cult doesn't work in the cities.
Durnek's frown became even more confused.
People who live in cities are always coming in contact with new people and new ideas, Barak explained. Out in the countryside, though, they can go for generations without ever encountering a single new thought. The bear cult doesn't believe in new thoughts, so it's the natural sort of thing to attract country people.
New ideas aren't always good ones, Durnek said stiffly, his own rural background painfully obvious.
Granted, Barak agreed, but old ones, they're not necessarily good either, and the bear cult's been working on the same idea for several thousand years now. About the last thing Balar said to the Aelorns before the gods departed was that they should lead the kingdoms of the West against the people of Torak. It's that word lead that has caused all of the problems. It can mean many things, unfortunately. Bear cultists have always taken it to mean that their very first step in obeying Balar's instructions should be a campaign to force the other Western kingdoms to submit to Aelorn domination. A good bear cultist isn't thinking about fighting Angrax because all of his attention is fixed on subduing Sindaria, Arendia, Tol'Nedra, Nyssa, and Maragor.
Maragor doesn't even exist anymore, Durnek objected.
That news hasn't reached the cult yet, Barak said dryly. After all, it's only been about 3,000 years now. Anyway, that's the rather tired idea behind the bear cult. Their first goal is to reunite Aloria. Their next is to overrun and subjugate all of the Western kingdoms, and only then will they start to give some thought to attacking Murkos and Malorians.
They are just a bit backward then, aren't they? Durnek observed.
Some of them haven't even discovered fire yet, Barak snorted.
I don't really see why Anhag is so concerned, Barak, Belgarath said. The bear cult doesn't really cause any problems out there in the countryside. They jump around bonfires on Midsummer's Eve, they put on bearskins and shuffle around in single file in the dead of winter, and recite long prayers in smoky caves until they get so dizzy that they can't stand up. Where's the danger in that?
I'm getting to it, Barak said, pulling at his beard. Always before, the rural bear cult was just a reservoir of undirected stupidity and superstition. But in the last year or so, something new has been going on.
Oh? Belgarath looked at him curiously.
There's a new leader of the cult. We don't even know who he is. In the past, bear cultists from one village didn't even trust the other ones, so they were never organized enough to be any problem. This new leader of theirs, he has changed all of that. For the first time in history, rural bear cultists are all taking orders from one man.
Belgarath frowned.
That is serious, he admitted.
This is very interesting, Barak, Geryon said, looking a bit perplexed. But why did King Angheg send you all the way here to warn me? From what I have been told, the bear cult has never been able to get a foothold here on the Isle of the Winds.
Angheg wanted me to warn you to take a few precautions, since this new cult's antagonism is directed primarily at you.
Me? What for?
You married a Tol'Nedrin, Barak told him. To a bear cultist, a Tol'Nedrin is worse than a Murgo.
That's a novel position, Tenedra said with a toss of her curls.
Yeah, that's the way these people think, Barak told her. Most of these blockheads don't even know what an Angrak is. They have all seen Tol'Nedrins, though, usually merchants who deal quite sharply. For 1,000 years they've been waiting for a king to come and pick up Riva's sword and lead them on a holy war to crush all of the kingdoms of the West into subjugation. And when he does finally show up, the very first thing he does is marry an imperial Tonedrin princess. The way they look at it, the next Riven king is going to be a mongrel. They hate you like a poison, my little sweetheart.
What an absolute absurdity, she exclaimed.
Of course it is, the big Kerak agreed. But absurdity has always been a characteristic of the mind dominated by this religion. We'd all be a lot better off if Baelor had just kept his mouth shut. Belgarath laughed suddenly. What's so funny? Asking Baelor to keep his mouth shut would probably have been the most futile thing any human being could even contemplate, the old sorcerer said, still laughing. I remember one time when he talked for 1.5 weeks straight, without stopping.
What was he saying? Geryon asked curiously.
He was explaining to the early Aelons why it wasn't a good idea to start a trek into the far north at the beginning of winter. Sometimes in those days you really had to talk to an Aelon to get an idea through to him.
That hasn't really changed all that much, Tenedra said, with an arch look at her husband. Then she laughed and fondly touched his hand.
The next morning dawned clear and sunny, and Erend, as he usually did, went to the window as soon as he awoke to see what the day promised. He looked out over the city of Vreva and saw the bright morning sun standing over the Sea of the Winds, and he smiled. There was not a hint of cloud. Today would be fine. He dressed himself in the tunic and hose which Polgara had laid out for him, and then went to join his family. Durnik and Polgara sat in 2 comfortable leather-upholstered chairs, one on each side of the fire, talking together quietly and sipping tea. As he always did, Erend went to Polgara, put his arms about her neck and kissed her.
"You slept late," she said, brushing his tousled hair back from his eyes. "I was a little tired," he replied. "I didn't get much sleep the night before last."
"So I heard." Almost absently, she pulled him up onto her lap and held him nestled against the soft velvet of her blue robe.
"He's growing a bit big for your lap," Durnik noted, smiling fondly at the 2 of them.
"I know," Polgara answered. "That's why I hold him as often as I can. Very soon he'll outgrow laps and cuddling, so I need to store up as much as I can now. It's all very well for them to grow up, but I miss the charm of having a small one about."
There was a brief tap at the door, and Belgarath entered.
"Well, good morning, father."
"Paul," he nodded briefly. "Durnik, did you manage to get Beric put to bed last night?" Durnik asked with a grin. "We poured him in about midnight. Bran's sons helped us with him. He seems to be getting heavier as he puts on the years."
"You are looking surprisingly well," Polgara observed, "considering the fact that you spent the evening at Geryon's ale barrel."
"I did not drink all that much," he told her,
coming to the fire to warm his hands. She looked at him with 1 raised eyebrow.
"I've got a lot on my mind," he said.
Then he looked directly at her.
"Is everything straightened out between Geryon and Tenedra?"
"I think so, yes."
"Let's be sure. I don't want things here to fly apart again. I'm going to have to get back to the Vale. But if you think you ought to stay and keep an eye on those 2, I can go on ahead."
His voice was serious, even decisive. Erend looked at the old man, noting once again that Belgarath seemed sometimes to be 2 different people. When there was nothing of any urgency going on, he reveled in his leisure, amusing himself with drink, deception, and petty theft. When a serious problem arose, however, he could set all of that aside and devote almost unlimited concentration and energy to solving it. Polgara quietly put Erend down and looked at her father.
"It is serious, then?"
"I don't know, Paul. And I don't like it when things are going on
that I don't know about. If you have finished with what you came here to do, I think we had better get back. As soon as we can get Beric on his feet, we'll have him take us to Kamar. We can pick up horses there. I need to talk with Belden, see if he knows anything about this Zandramas thing.
We'll be ready whenever you want to leave, Father.
Later that same morning, Erend went to the stables to say goodbye to the frolicsome young horse. He was a bit sad to be leaving it so soon. He was genuinely fond of Geryon and Zenedra. The young king of Riva was, in many ways, like a brother to Erend, and Zenedra was delightful, when she was not going out of her way to be difficult. Most of all, however, he was going to miss the horse. Erend did not think of the horse as a beast of burden. They were both young and shared a wholehearted enthusiasm for each other's company. The boy stood in the center of the exercise yard with the long-legged animal frisking about him in the bright morning sunlight. Then he caught a movement out of the corner of his eye and turned and saw Durnek and Geryon approaching.
"Good morning, Erend,"
the Riven King said.
"Belgarion,
you and the horse seem to be enjoying yourselves."
"We're friends," Erend said. "We like to be together."
Geryon looked almost sadly at the chestnut-hued animal. The horse came to him and curiously nuzzled at his clothing. Geryon rubbed the pointed ears and ran his hand down the smooth, glossy forehead. Then he sighed.
"Would you like to have him for your very own?" "You don't own friends, Belgarion."
"You're right," Geryon agreed.
"But would you like it if he went back to the Vale with you?" "But he likes you, too."
"I can always come and visit," the Riven King said. "There really isn't much room for him to run here, and I'm always so busy that I don't have the time to spend with him the way I should. I think it would be best for him if he went with you. What do you think?"
Erend considered that, trying to think only of the well-being of the young animal and not of his own personal preferences. He looked at Geryon and saw how much this generous offer had cost his friend. When he finally answered, his voice was quiet and very serious.
"I think you're right, Belgarion. The Vale would be better for him. He wouldn't have to be penned up there."
"You'll have to train him," Geryon said. "He's never been ridden."
"He and I can work on that,"
Erend assured him.
"He'll go with you then." "Thank you."
"You're welcome, Erend."
"And done."
Erend could hear the voice as clearly as if it had spoken in his own mind.
"What?"
Geryon's silent reply was startled.
"Excellently done, Geryon. I want these two to be together. They have things to do that need the both of them."
Then the voice was gone.